rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Smith, Judge Bradfold, the Honorable Kevin Ross presiding.
Please be seated.
Good morning and welcome to this panel of the Minnesota Court of Appeals for this January 8, 2025 series of oral arguments. We have four cases on our calendar this morning for argument. The first case we have is Lesch v. Lesch. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. If I'm not, I'm sure you'll correct me. Hope that you will. Is my microphone on?
Yep.
Okay, good. Counsel, just to remind you of our rules, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your arguments with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument because we keep an audio recording of the proceedings only. And that way, individuals will be able to match you to the argument that you're presenting. There is a time and or a clock and a light in the lectern which lets you keep track of the time. And by the way, there's also a button in front if you haven't used it before. You can raise and lower the lectern to your height for your convenience. With that, counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Good morning. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Lamari J. Santana, and I'm counsel for the appellant, Mr. John Lesch. The appellant, John Patrick Lesch, and the respondent, Melissa Sidney Reed, were married on September 8th of 2012. The parties have two joint minor children, Eleanor, born June 17th of 2016, and Isla, born July 30th of 2019.
Now, it's entirely up to you if you'd like to go through the facts, but we have read the briefs, and if you'd like to jump into the legal argument, you can. It's your 15 minutes to use however you want. Just wanted to cue you that you don't have to spend as much time as you might otherwise think.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. I think what I want to start with is just talking about the relief that the court ordered in this case is the district court awarded the parties joint physical custody. The district court awarded a wife or the respondent sole legal custody and then reduced the my appellant's parenting time from a 50-50 schedule to 5 overnights every 14 days or 35%.
When you say reduced, just to be clear, that what was in place was only a temporary custody
order. That is correct, Your Honor.
So there's no reduction in the sense of a modification. It's just the court begins with a lesser time for father when the court finally dealt with the issues.
That is correct. There was a temporary order issued on May 24, 2021, and so that temporary order granted appellant a 50-50 schedule or 7 overnights out of every 14. And when the court issued its final order in August of 2023, it issued an order that granted him 5 overnights or 35% of the parenting time, which was a reduction of the parenting time that the parents had been exercising since the temporary order. Now, the appellant filed a motion for amended findings, and after the motion for amended findings was heard, the court did issue an amended order. And in that amended order...
Now, we are, again, aware of the facts. If you'd like to explain to us why you believe the district court was wrong, we can get into the issues.
Yes. And so from our perspective, the bottom line is that in this case, the district court abused its discretion and erred in awarding sole legal custody to mother and arbitrarily reducing the husband's parenting time because of his alleged use of a live-in nanny after work hours. That's basically what the court's decision boils down to. If you read it, the court awarded sole legal custody to mother simply based on some personality-based assessment that really had nothing to do with the party's actual day-to-day living and actual functioning or the children's best interest. And the court ordered a parenting time schedule that was a reduction of the parenting time that father was exercising for over 2 years by the time that the order came out, based on allegations that he had a live-in nanny that provided care for the children after work hours, when the court, there wasn't even sufficient evidence for the court to make that finding, because the finding specifically says, based on the allegation that he has a live-in nanny that provides care after work hours.
Let me just tell you how I might have characterized it differently. You tell me if you think I'm wrong. I thought the basis, the primary basis for the district court's order of sole legal custody was a significant conflict over a major facet of the children's life going forward, which is their religious upbringing, that there was a disagreement and that the district court credited mother's assertion about an arrangement or an agreement about the children being raised in the Jewish faith and father now interfering with that, and that the parenting time issue was based mostly on the point that you're raising now, which was during father's time, the nanny, father's nanny and romantic interest was spending a lot of time as the caregiver, even when father was home. I thought that's how I interpreted the district court's analysis. And if you think I'm wrong, correct me.
Well, I would like to correct you, Your Honor, on that, because even in the respondent's brief, they alleged that religion was not a basis for the court's decision. And if the court reviews the district court's decision with regard to the factor, where it was factor one, where the court addressed religion, the court didn't weigh or balance that issue, right? And in the custody evaluation, when the custody evaluator talked about religion and weighed and balanced that issue, he said that factor was neutral. So ultimately, even though that's an issue that was raised, the way that the custody evaluator dealt with the religion issue is he said, that's an issue, and the court found that it was an issue. But interestingly enough, the custody evaluator put a protocol in place for the parties to address that going forward that the district court did not put in place, which we indicate as error. With regard to the district court,
on that point, since that is a legal issue you've raised,
yep,
I understand that your client disagrees with that as the solution. The district court resolved it by saying sole custody to mother. Your view is that instead there should have been an evaluator or a special master comes in and helps the party with that decision. What is the basis in law for us to conclude that the district court's choice was an abuse of discretion?
The basis in law is that the district court did, number one, added evidence to the record to address the religion issue. That is one factor that is extremely concerning in this case, because if you look at the amended order, in order to make a finding that father's position on the religion issue was not credible, the district court went in and added an article from 2024 regarding catechism to indicate and make a finding that father's position was not credible on that. Now, that is extremely concerning. That is an abuse of discretion, because...
Is that the only basis for the district court making that finding? I thought the district court pointed out that father participated in the renaming ceremony, or the Hebrew naming ceremony, and that the children were not, which is an initial rite in the Jewish faith, and the parties did not, neither, at least for one of the children of the two, and the parties did not have any of the children baptized in the Catholic faith, which is the initiation in the Catholic faith. Mm-hmm. Isn't that part of the basis of the district court's decision?
Well, it's part of it, but what I'm saying is that the basis for the district court's decision in relying on the catechism was not based on evidence that was brought out at trial. The district court listened to father's position with regard to the party's religious practices, and what this was an interfaith home, where at the beginning of the party's marriage, he testified that they had a Catholic ceremony and they had a Jewish ceremony. They had a Jewish naming ceremony for one of the children, but they didn't have a Jewish naming ceremony for their second daughter as of the time that the proceedings began. The other part that the court ignored is that the minor child was enrolled in a Catholic preschool. And so from our perspective, the reason that the district court's findings are erroneous with regard to the religious issue is because the court simply considered the facts and circumstances that mother was presenting, but did not consider the objective evidence and other evidence that father put in the record that contradicted the court's findings. And not only that, and what really points to the fact that the court was reaching with regard to that issue, is that the court went outside the record to look for evidence that was not part of the record in order to make a finding that the appellant's position was not credible or was incorrect.
May I ask, one didn't need to go outside the record to find, as the court found, neither child was baptized in a Catholic faith.
No, and
okay.
That's accurate.
So the only thing outside the record is that typically in a Catholic religion occurs at birth and precedes other sacraments. I mean, even without that, even if you don't generally know that and rely on a catechism book as opposed to general knowledge, still they were not baptized in a Catholic faith, which is the first part of that sentence.
Well, it is true that the children were not baptized in the Catholic faith, but the point that the finding that the court made was not the children were not baptized in the Catholic faith. The finding that the court made was, and by the way, the fact that that is a ritual that has to happen in the Catholic faith when they're, you know, when they're very young. And the court went outside the record.
The finding. It did find that they were not baptized, and it found based on catechism that it's a rite that typically takes place at birth.
Exactly. And so,
any dispute? I mean, some things are of common knowledge. Why isn't that? Why does the district court, the fact that no one actually testified to that, I'm just wondering the significance of the district court's reliance on a proposition that I don't think can be in any realistic dispute.
Well, Your Honor, this is the problem with that, is that the district court went outside the evidence of record to look for a proposition that, you know, even if it is common knowledge, that wasn't in evidence at all. There was no discussion about that particular Catholic rite or when it needed to happen. And the court went outside the record to look for that proposition in order to say that his position was not credible or that particular rite or the way it was conducted was something that affected his credibility on that. And that is really concerning because the court made credibility determinations throughout its findings. And I find that if the district court had to go outside the record to look for something that wasn't presented at trial in order to attack the appellant's credibility, that calls into question all the other credibility findings that the district court made. And that's the crux of our case, is that the district court looked at the case, reviewed the evidence that was presented, made credibility determinations, but when you actually look at the evidence that we submitted at trial, those credibility determinations don't withstand scrutiny. And for example, the district court agreed with the custody evaluator that the appellant's personality or that his interpersonal difficulties were something that affected his ability to make decisions and to co-parent and make decisions with the respondent. When you look at the evidence that was actually submitted at trial, the evidence was that for more than 2 years, both parents co-parented, managed everyday living for both of these children. They made decisions with regard to their everyday living. And the fact is that these were two really small kids. They were ages 1 and 3 when the case started. And by the end of it, they were ages, 4 and 6. So in order to manage the day-to-day care for children this age, the parents have to be able to communicate. They have to be able to manage their medical care. They have to be able to deal with day-to-day circumstances. And they did that effectively for 2 years. The best evidence of that is the fact that wife or respondent started requesting sole physical custody and sole legal custody. By the end of the custody evaluation, she told the evaluators, "I agree that we should share joint physical and joint legal." To me, the fact that respondent, during the evaluation, changed her mind, that speaks volumes about the ability of these parents to get together and make decisions about these children. And that shows that the district court's finding that they were incapable of making decisions together and that they had to rely on their attorneys to make decisions is absolutely wrong. Because at no time during the proceedings did the parties go to the court to ask the court to make any decision with regard to any legal custody issue at all. And there was no evidence.
May I ask, was religion not a point of conflict at this point? At this point? And how does that factor in, like, the whether even if parties had an agreement at the initial determination of legal custody, which this is, that might involve a religious dispute? I mean, does a court have to enforce an agreement that they made at the trial, marriage or earlier?
Absolutely. That's our position. Our position is that there was no agreement, that this was an interfaith household where the parties, mom was Jewish, dad was Catholic, and they were just, you know, they were working together to figure out what was going to happen because these kids were so young and they were so little that they didn't have a plan or a contract as to how they were going to be raised. If from our perspective, if you look at the evidence, what really happened here is that this religious conflict was something that was concocted and fabricated by mother during the custody evaluation because one time the child came home and allegedly, because we don't know, recited a prayer. The only reason we know that this child supposedly recited a Jewish prayer is because mother told, my time is up, Your Honor.
You can finish your thought.
Okay, because mother told the evaluator that this child recited something called the Lord's Prayer. The evaluator took that, asked my client about it. He denied, no, that's not what happened. Then interviewed the child. The child could not recite the Lord's Prayer. And then from that, somehow, this whole religious issue exploded into something that was not a conflict between these parties. It just wasn't. And so if you look at what happened, mother took that incident, went to the evaluator and said, oh my God, he's doing this to hurt me. From that one incident and one email, all of a sudden it turned into it was happening regularly. There was no evidence of that. And when I cross-examined the evaluator on that point, he said, I don't know where I got the idea that it was happening regularly. It only happened once.
Thank you. Your time has expired, but you will
Thank
have
you,
an,
Your Honor.
You will have an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal time. Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sam Carusi, and I'm here on behalf of the respondent, Melissa Sidney Reed. Now, Judge Ross had asked about whether religion was the main reason behind the court's decision. I would argue that, well, yes, religion was probably the most prominent issue addressed in these factors. I think the religion issue was a symptom of what was described in the really thorough psychological evaluations that were conducted on these parties. So this is more than just the court simply determining, oh, well, this party has a more difficult personality. This isn't a personality test. Mr. Lesh was diagnosed with a personality disorder. And it had components of four discrete personality disorders. And Dr. Albert, who did the psychological evaluation, Mr. Goldfarb, who did the custody evaluation, and the court all concluded that father's personality issues and personality disorders were more likely to negatively impact the children than mother's. Mother certainly had her issues, but they affected the children in a minimal fashion. Specifically, the court found, quote, that father's mental health is likely to negatively affect the children's safety or developmental needs. One of the ways in which that manifested was one of the primary legal custody issues, which is religion.
Before the, as the court is aware, before the divorce was commenced, the parties both contributed or both participated in a Hebrew naming ceremony for the oldest child. The youngest child, there was testimony, was not old enough yet, and then COVID hit.
But there was also evidence that the children attended Catholic Mass services and during holidays.
There is, but there is no question from the record that these were Jewish children living in a home that respected multiple faiths. It does not make the children also Catholic.
It doesn't make them also Catholic, but they participated in non-Jewish Christian or Catholic ceremonies.
Certainly. And that was their father's faith, but the children were Jewish.
Which mother supported?
Yes.
At the time.
Yes. And
I mean, obviously the Catholic versus Jewish conflict was probably going to percolate at some point, but I was looking for evidence that supported the idea of an agreement that the district court seemed to base part of its decision on. And it wasn't compelling evidence, but maybe you can talk about that.
So the evidence of that agreement, Your Honor, is his father's own words. When he presented for the Rule 25 assessment, he told the professional conducting the assessment, and this is in the record, I'm Catholic, my wife is Jewish, we raise our girls Jewish. It was Mr. Lesh who then changed positions and started surreptitiously sort of inserting little things here and there. The girls were reciting the Lord's Prayer instead of the Shema. And these were little barbs that Mr.
What is the evidence that the girls were reciting the Lord's Prayer?
The evidence that the girls were reciting the Lord's Prayer is that Mother heard them recite the Lord's Prayer and corrected them. She testified to that, and she told Mr. Goldfarb about that. The court made specific findings that is indeed what happened. The court found Mother more credible on that issue. The court found Father lacked credibility as to the religious issue, and that, in fact, he was misrepresenting the party's agreement, saying that indeed the parties did agree to raise the children Jewish and took affirmative steps. The notion of the best interest factor, I mean, this is not, as Mr. Lesh would like to point out, the court favoring one religion or over another or discriminating against him because he's a Catholic. This is the court saying these children are Jewish. We're not going to confuse these children as to what their religion is when their parents.
It's not our place to substitute our judgment for the district courts, but I will tell you what struck me about this case as I read the record, including extremely thorough, probably the most thorough custody evaluation I've ever seen, is that after all of that, the district court determined sole custody and assigned it to Mother. And that was a surprise, given the types of conflicts that we've seen that in the district court that have come up in our cases that haven't resolved. That where the district court says, okay, there's conflict, there's difficulty, but yet let's start with joint custody, and help the parties to work navigate their way through that until the hostilities about the separation or divorce wane. So that surprised me in this case. And maybe that's how we got here, that the parties were surprised, or at least the appellant was surprised by the result, given Mother's concession during the evaluation that joint custody would be appropriate.
You know, and I think if Mother said that during the process, there might have been moments where she would have been okay with it. She had requested sole legal custody, and that was her legal position throughout. I think the court and Mr. Goldfarb both noted Mother's flexibility, her open-mindedness, her ability to put the conflict aside and her feelings about Mr. Lesh aside to co-parent for the children. The court did not find that to be true about Mr. Lesh. In fact, Mr. Lesh, a self-described contrarian,
But how does that bear upon there was significant evidence and concessions made during the trial that during this period, of equal parenting time, that they were able to make decisions. There was some disagreement, but they were able to make decisions, and there wasn't the major conflict that often shows up in our courts as a basis for sole custody or as a basis for significantly limited parenting time. Can you speak to that?
So it's not the issue of, so I would, I would disagree slightly with that, Your Honor, in that there were multiple, again, Mr. Lesch's ability to kind of needlepoint these relatively, in isolation, what would be minor conflicts, but to gather them up overall as an attempt to undermine mother's parenting is evident. At trial, father and mother both testified about an incident in which father got the children kicked out of daycare because he was making a problem with the COVID compliance policy or something. And that is one reason I say that the religious differences are, they feature prominently and certainly feature prominently in appellant's argument. They are not the sole reason for the decision. The sole reason is these people each have different approaches to problem solving, and when they arise, father can't put his feelings for mother aside and act in the children's best interest. And that is manifest by his surreptitious teaching them Catholic religious traditions or to engage in them. And the numerous other examples of father simply just putting little roadblocks in the way. Was it enough that mother wanted to spend thousands of dollars and a few months petition or motioning for and then getting a temporary decision? No. But the absence of interim motion practice does not mean that the parties are capable of co-parenting in a way that serves the children's best interest. There were issues regarding the school. And there were issues regarding father's unwillingness to compromise on those issues where the court seems to have determined these children need a solution and they need to have decisions made for them. If the parents are not going to be able to come to an agreement when no one's looking, when there's no one looking over their shoulder, when they're not trying to look good for a custody evaluation or a trial, it does stand to reason that it's best to put authority with one person. And the court found that that person was Ms. Reed. So I'd like to speak to something that counsel for the appellant said about inserting evidence, and I don't believe the court inserted evidence. I believe the court cited the catechism, but did recognize the children weren't baptized, and I think that's common knowledge.
Could you address the hearsay argument?
The hearsay argument? Yes, Your Honor. So Mr. Goldfarb, in the course of his evaluation, relied on a number of statements. One of the core functions of a custody evaluator is to avoid the necessity of bringing children in to testify, among many others. One of the ways in which a custody evaluator does that is by interviewing the children. It's simply not impermissible hearsay. It's of the type that 703A contemplates when it allows an expert to base their opinion on hearsay testimony.
What about a young child making an alleged statement to mother, which mother relays to the evaluator, which the evaluator then builds into the evaluation, which the district court relies upon? I think that's the primary argument about hearsay here. Mm-hmm.
So I would argue that is appropriate under 703A. If that is the type that a custody evaluator typically relies upon, and custody evaluators are typically checking in with parents, they do multiple interviews, and parents report what their children say and do. That is not an unusual part. Even if that alone were inadmissible, Mr. Goldfarb based his conclusion on a number of factors, including asking Father and making credibility determinations about what Father's telling him. He had opportunities to speak with Father's significant other herself, and he came to the conclusion that he generally believed that, not that Father wasn't providing any care for the children, but that at certain times his partner was providing the lion's share of care. And while there's nothing wrong with that in and of itself,
what's the evidence that supports that other than the evaluator's conclusions based upon mom's statement? What was it mom's statements about what was happening in dad's house? Because there was counter evidence about dad's involvement. Particularly I'm focusing on when dad was not at work, so dad was capable and at home, what is the evidence that supports the idea that during those times, on weekends and after hours, the lion's share of the child care was going to what the district court described as the live-in nanny?
Yes.
What's the trial evidence of that besides the reliance on hearsay?
So there was Dr. Goldfarb's conclusion based on not just what had been relayed to him about what the children said, but there was also the history of providing the care that he relied on. So, for example, Ms. Reed testified that that father's MO when he was home was that he would not typically be as engaged. There were periods of engagement. He did fun things.
I'm talking about the time of trial.
Yes.
And based upon this 2-year period, the period where they had equal parenting time, what is the evidence that he was sort of the checked out dad and that the live-in nanny was substantially providing the child care?
So I don't think anyone would characterize him, including Ms. Reed, as a checked out dad. He did provide some care for the children, but Mr. Goldfarb credibly found that he did not believe Father when he was giving he didn't believe what Father was telling him.
But what's the basis in the record for the district court's finding that Father, that the live-in nanny was substantially the child care provider, or at least significantly, during his parenting time, even when he was home? What was the basis for the district court? I mean, the argument is the basis is mom's representations based upon what she heard from the child, or mom's belief and her characterizations. Besides that, what was the evidence?
So aside from that, I mean, we didn't have cameras in the home. I mean, we didn't have, all we had were the testimony of the parties and the witnesses. And
wasn't there contrary evidence presented by dad about that from other parties, not just dad?
Dad presented evidence that he was at times engaged with the children, and I think Ms. Reed concedes that.
I'm not talking about at times. I mean, the district court seemed to be perhaps properly focused on that concern. Does dad spend a significant amount of time as dad when he has the time to do it, when he's not at work and there's someone else in the home, or does he defer to someone else? I think that was a significant part of the district court's analysis, and I'm wondering, what, given the fact that there was contrary evidence, what was the basis, what's the basis for the district court's finding? Other than mom's representations, given mom was not in the home?
Aside from Mr. Goldfarb's impressions as the person on the ground, kind of determining who's credible and who's not, there was not specific documentary or other evidence, if that's what the court's asking.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
Your Honor, in addressing this father's engagement with these children, I think one piece of evidence that's really important is the evidence that was not refuted, that when Eleanor was suffering and in pain at her mother's house, she and mother couldn't handle the situation. Eleanor was calling out for her dad. And I think that when we're thinking about overall the district court's findings and what the district court did here, is that and why it's an abuse of discretion is because the district court ignored the evidence that father presented that contradicted mother's position, that contradicted the findings that the custody evaluator made. One stark incident during the trial is that the evaluator made a finding that father had such interpersonal difficulties that it impacted the child care provider. He made that finding, and the court relied on that. But then when we review the file and we look at what really happened, he made a finding that there was interpersonal difficulty and that that conversation that my client had with that daycare provider showed that he was mocking and how difficult he was. When I asked him, did you review the communications themselves? No, I did not. And that's the problem in this case, is that over and over, the deficiencies in that evaluation and the evidence of mother's behavior, that when we look at mother's behavior and we look at the court's finding that she is a better communicator, that she is in a position to cooperate and make decisions, when we look at the court's findings, it is an abuse of discretion. This is a parent who, in the psychological evaluation, the psychological evaluation indicated that she wanted to prove her case, that she had such disdain and hatred for fathers that she called him a black hole during her testimony. And that during the case itself and during the evaluation, she was so dead set on giving the evaluator paperwork that he didn't even ask for, that she left the baby in the bathtub. And then during the evaluation, this parent takes a video of her daughter naked from the waist down, interrogates her about what's happening at dad's house, is he brushing your teeth, and then makes comments to her in leading questioning about how her dad may not be meeting her needs. And she provides this to the evaluator. The evaluator didn't even mention that in his report. Nothing about that. Can we imagine for one moment if father had done that? If he had taken a video questioning his daughter naked from the waist down and submitted that as evidence of mother's inability to take care of her? What would have happened? The evaluator doesn't even mention that, and that's the problem in this case, is that in the zeal to get to conclusions about how bad father supposedly is, the district court ignored significant evidence that is very concerning about how mother operated. And yes, that is evidence that her own mental health issues had an impact on how she dealt with the children. There was no direct evidence, none. And they couldn't point to in their brief, and the district court could not directly point to any evidence that father's interpersonal issues had any impact on the children. The children were thriving, they were doing great. And Eleanor, in a time of need, when she was in pain, she called for dad when she was at mom's house. And dad called, took care of her. They resolved the situation. The next day, they took her to the doctor, and they moved on in the middle of getting ready for a custody trial. Eleanor's need for her dad speaks more about his connection and his caretaking and his ability to co-parent?
The district court's order seems to direct the parties at exchanges to say only hello and goodbye and nothing else, and not to have any communication outside of the portal.
Sure.
What was the basis of that?
I believe the basis of that, as I understood it, was because of one incident where there was, like, the first time that the parents exchanged the children right after the temporary order came out, there was difficulty because respondents' parents went to go pick up the child and exchanged some really, really difficult text messages. And so, again, That probably was the basis for that. But then for the rest of the case, they had the exchanges. They were talking on our family wizard. And even the respondent, you know, admitted during the trial numerous instances where they agreed on numerous different issues with regard to the children's caretaking. So, you know, when we're looking overall, I'm sorry, Your Honor, my time is up, but I just
wrap up asked, with one sentence if you can.
Yep. I asked the court, in looking at the record in this case, is that the issue with this case and why the district court abuses discretion, is it because it failed to consider the significant evidence that countervailed the respondent's position, as Your Honor mentioned, and the court didn't even mention exhibits that were submitted by the respondent, exhibits 287, 288, and 289, which were the letter from his eldest daughter to the custody evaluator, the testimony from the nanny, who was so upset by how mother interfered with the parenting time that she was contacting father and trying to arrange parenting time before the temporary order was entered. And then the text messages that showed respondent engaging in drug-seeking behavior with her stepdaughter, who was the kid that she raised. So what we did in this case is we're just going to look the other way.
Thank you.
With mother's issues and not address them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you to both counsel. Thank you for your legal briefing, very thorough. Matter is submitted. We'll issue our decision within the statutory period. We appreciate, however we decide this case, that there are significant personal issues involved and emotional issues. And, of course, we only look at the legal questions, but we are mindful of the underlying concerns that both parents have. And we appreciate both your advocacy on behalf of your clients. Thank you. We'll issue our opinion, and matter is submitted.
Thank you. Sorry for taking a little bit.
No need to apologize.